Chapter 5. Class Ceiling. Poor boys and men are suffering. In 2017, a new phrase entered the lexicon of social science: deaths of despair. Popularized by the scholars Anne Case and Angus Deaton, the term refers to mortality from drug overdoses, suicides, and alcohol-related illnesses. In an academic paper and subsequent 2020 book, Case and Deaton highlight the rise in deaths of despair among middle-aged, less educated whites. They argue that declining economic fortunes in the working class have combined with various forms of social breakdown, especially in family life, to create patterns of cumulative disadvantage, or more bluntly, as they put it, the collapse of the white working class. But this is a story about gender, too. Overall, deaths of despair are almost 3 times higher among men than women. I've argued that black boys and men face particular disadvantages because of gendered racism. This is why it's vitally important to examine gender through the lens of race, and vice versa. But the same is true of social class. At the top of the economic ladder, especially in the top 20% of the income distribution, both women and men are flourishing on almost all measures, from their growing wealth to the lengthening spans of their lives. This was the focus of my previous book, Dream Hoarders. Below this top bracket, men are working less than in the past and at lower wages. The wage gap between men and women has narrowed, but the gap between highly paid workers and everybody else has widened. In 1979, the earnings of the typical woman were 63% those of the typical man. By 2019, this had risen to 82%. By contrast, the wages of the typical worker, i.e. at the median, fell from 54% of the wages of a high earner, i.e. at the 90th percentile, to 42% by 2019. By these measures, then, the gender pay gap narrowed by 19 percentage points, while the class pay gap widened by 12 percentage points. Class warriors downplay gender concerns focused only on the oligarchy. Gender warriors downplay class concerns focused only on the patriarchy. But inequalities of class and gender have to be considered together, especially when they pull in different directions. As Nick Hillman and Nicholas Robinson write, policymaking is not a zero-sum game in which you have to choose between caring about female disadvantage or the socioeconomic gap or male underachievement. All three matter. Focusing too narrowly on the remaining barriers facing women can distract attention from the much deeper class divides that have opened up in our society. We might lean in, but fail to look down. In this chapter, I set out the evidence on male deaths of despair, show how the economic difficulties of working-class men ends up hurting families and putting more pressure on women, and describe how many of these men have lost connection to social institutions that once anchored male identity, including marriage. I also describe how childhood disadvantage hurts boys more than girls, resulting in a corrosive intergenerational cycle. As working-class men struggle, their families become poorer, and in these families, boys suffer most, which damages their prospects in adult life. The male malaise becomes an inherited condition. It might seem odd to put so much stress on economic inequality in a book about boys and men, but I've come to see the two problems as inseparable. There is simply no way to reduce economic inequality without improving the fortunes of less advantaged boys and men. Deaths of despair. When Donald Trump talked about American carnage in his inaugural address, I admit to having rolled my eyes. I thought it was ridiculous hyperbole. Now, I think it was only hyperbole. Trump knew who he was talking to. The counties with the most deaths of despair were the ones who swung most decisively to him in 2016 compared to Mitt Romney's performance in 2012. These are also the communities where employment has declined most sharply, especially for men. Men in particular felt the loss not only of income but also of dignity that accompanied a good job, write Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun, authors of Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope, a study of communities hit hardest by recent economic trends. As they go on, lonely and troubled, They self-medicated with alcohol or drugs, and they accumulated criminal records that left them less employable and less marriageable. Family structure collapsed. The work from Case and Deaton and others on deaths of despair shows that drug-related deaths have risen sharply. Opioids are obviously a big part of the story here, and men account for almost 70% of the opioid overdose deaths in the US. Almost half the prime-age men out of the labor force in 2016 said they had taken pain medication the previous day, mostly at prescription strength, according to a survey analyzed by Princeton economist Alan Krueger. He suggested that the increase in opioid prescriptions from 1999 to 2015 could account for almost half, 43%, of the drop in male employment over the same time period. Of course, poor job prospects might be fueling opioid use as much as the other way around. A review of employment trends by the Maryland economists Catherine Abraham and Melissa Carney concludes that, although it seems clear that the problems of depressed labor force participation and opioid use are interrelated, the arrows of causality run in both directions. I think opioids are just as much a barometer of social problems as they are a cause. Opioids are not like other drugs, which might be taken to artificially boost confidence, energy, or illumination. There is a reason people take MDMA in a dance club or psychedelics on a spiritual quest. Opioids are taken simply to numb pain, perhaps physical pain at first, then existential pain. They are not drugs of inspiration or rebellion, but of isolation and retreat. One reason that so many people die from opioid overdoses is that users are typically indoors and very often alone. Men are also much more likely to commit suicide than women. This is a worldwide, long-standing pattern, but the gender gap is widest in more advanced economies, where men are about 3 times more likely than women to take their own life. Suicide is now the biggest killer of British men under the age of 45. In the US, suicide rates have risen fastest among middle-aged men, but there has also been a big increase in recent decades among adolescent and younger men too. Suicide rates for women have increased too, from a much lower starting point, but remain well below those for men. In a 2019 essay on masculinity, published in Harper's Magazine, Barrett Swanson noted how many of his male friends and neighbours seemed dislocated in one way or another. As he writes, "Several of these men struggled with addiction and depression or other conditions that could be named, but the more common complaint was something vaguer, a quiet desperation that, if I were forced to generalise, seemed to stem from a gnawing sense of purposelessness." In a study of suicides, Australian researcher Fiona Shand and her colleagues looked at the words or phrases that men who have attempted suicide most often use to describe themselves. At the top of the list were useless and worthless. The true cause of the male malaise, I believe, is not lack of labour force participation, but cultural redundancy. Family misfortunes. When men struggle, families become poorer. One of the most striking facts about recent economic history is that it is only women who have kept American families financially afloat in the last few decades. And even then, just barely. Except for the richest families, i.e. the top fifth, all of the growth in household income since 1979 resulted from the increased working hours and earnings of women. As Heather Boucher, appointed in 2021 to the Council of Economic Advisers, and Kavya Vagal write, "Women's contributions saved low-income and middle-class families from steep drops in their income." We should not make the mistake of assuming that women were somehow forced into work against their will just to keep food on the table. No doubt this was true in some cases. But most women, including mothers, want to earn a living, and certainly want to have that option rather than being dependent on a man. The point here is simply that if men were doing better, most families would benefit. Since women continue to take most responsibility for childcare, they often also end up working what the sociologist Arlie Hochschild labelled a second shift of domestic labour on top of their job. The double shift is most acute, of course, for those who are raising children alone. In the US, 1 in 4 children under 18 are being raised by a single adult, 82% of whom are mothers. These women, by definition, shoulder a heavier burden, but they are also often reluctant to commit to a relationship. Sociologists Catherine Eden and Maria Kefalas show in their book, Promises I Can Keep, Why Poor Women Put Motherhood Before Marriage, that many women in poor neighborhoods have come to see men, including the fathers of their children, as just another mouth to feed, an inversion of the men's expected role. With the rise in female earning power, men need to clear a higher bar to be seen as husband material. Women are more likely to go it alone than partner with a man who is in a weak economic position. As Eden and Kefalas's ethnographic work illustrates, many women decide that I can do bad by myself. In the bottom fifth of the income distribution, 7 out of 10 mothers are now the main breadwinner, usually because they're the only one. This growing class gap in family life shows how economic factors, especially the position of men, both in absolute terms and relative to women, influences family formation. The falling earnings power of non-college males is one reason for their falling marriage rates, according to David Autor and Melanie Wasserman. Even as marriage has weakened as an economic institution, it has retained much of its symbolic power. In 2015, after a long fight, lesbian and gay couples won the right to wed in the US. Within 2 years, 3 out of 5 cohabiting same-sex couples were married. But as one gap closed, another opened up by social class. Marriage rates among well-educated, affluent Americans have held steady at quite high levels in recent decades, but have fallen for everybody else. In 1979, there was almost no difference in marriage rates by social class. Today, there's a wide gap. The marriage rate of men aged 40 to 44 with a high school education or less has dropped by more than 20 percentage points over the past 40 years, compared to 6 percentage points for those with a college education. As my colleague Isabel Sawhill has written, family formation is a new fault line in the American class structure. Most births to women with only a high school diploma now occur outside marriage, 59%. But the same is true for just 1 in 10 births to women with a 4-year college degree. Andrew Cherlin's work shows that even if college-educated women are not married when they have their first child, they are quite likely to be married by the time they have their second, usually to the man who is the father of both children. As he concludes, marriage remains more central to the family lives of college-educated Americans than to those without college educations. There's something of a paradox here. The women who have achieved the greatest degree of economic independence, with high levels of education and earning potential, are the ones who are now most likely to get married and stay married. I don't think Gloria Steinem or anyone else thought that this was how things would unfold. Even she eventually got married at the age of 66, explaining, "We are at an age when marriage can be chosen and not expected." I think educated Americans have transformed marriage from an institution of economic dependency into a joint venture for the purpose of parenting. Marriage here serves primarily as a commitment device for shared investments of time and money in children. I call these high investment parenting, or HIP, marriages. Affluent, highly educated parents have more flexibility at work, more money to outsource domestic labor, and more wealth or credit to buy time at home if they choose. If one of them takes time out of the labor market, the family finances will survive. That study of MBA graduates I cited back in Chapter 2, showing how time taken to care for children has caused a gender pay gap, also found that women with the highest earning husbands were the most likely to take time out of the labor market. This underscores the differences in the position of men of different classes. College-educated men have been largely insulated from the labor market shocks that have derailed so many others. With high and rising earnings, they have remained attractive marital prospects, even for women who are themselves flourishing in the labor market. These men have not, by and large, become stay-at-home dads, however. Even at the top of the ladder, there is a lot to be said for sharing the breadwinning between two winners. Educated Americans have also heard and absorbed the messages about the importance of family stability for children's prospects. Professional men have modernized enough to be good partners without having to give up the traditional trappings of male status, especially as providers. Life is very different for men with waning wages and truncated job prospects. Equality is easier for the affluent. The class gap in family life reflects and reinforces social and economic inequality. High earners are pooling resources in households shared with other high earners. Low earners, not so much. As the economist Shoshana Grossbard and her co-authors write, when considering all households, the factor accounting most for the increased inequality during this period, 1973 to 2013, is an increased tendency for individual men and women to remain single. Affluent couples are also able to invest much more heavily in their children. The result is diverging destinies among children, greater economic responsibility and independence for women, and a growing number of men who are unburdened and unmoored, according to Shelley Lundberg and her co-authors. The haphazard self. Without a script, there is no choice for many men except to improvise. But improvising a successful life is a very difficult task. A model of stable masculinity, writes David Morgan, would include a relatively high degree of congruence between public discourses about masculinity and the public and private practices of masculinity. For individual men, there would be a sense of ontological security. This is not a great slogan. What do we want? Ontological security. When do we want it? Now. But this is, in fact, exactly what many men are seeking: a more solid social anchor, more certainty about how to be in the world. Over the course of 13 years, a team of qualitative researchers led by Catherine Eden conducted in-depth interviews with men in four American cities. In the resulting 2019 paper, The Tenuous Attachments of Working Class Men, they chart the erosion of key institutional frameworks for mature masculinity, especially work, family, and religion. These core institutions, Eden and her co-authors write, created the attachments, investments, involvements, and beliefs that guided and gave meaning to human activity in specific social domains. They also organized social activity into common patterns of behavior and supplied norms, beliefs, and rituals that legitimated such patterns. As the title of their paper implies, many working-class men are now only tenuously attached to these institutions of work, faith, and family. In these circumstances, as they write, a few may craft lives that are more rewarding than those of prior generations, but the majority will struggle. The result is an increased number of men with what the team labels a haphazard self, oscillating between different plans and priorities, struggling to stay on any particular track, and often slipping backward. In Colebrook, anthropologist Jennifer Silver's label for a town in the Anthracite region of Pennsylvania, massive transformations in gender, work, and family have ripped open men's lives and left them scrambling to put them back together. Here, in the run-up to the 2016 election, Silver reports that Donald Trump was viewed positively as a man's man. Silver shows how some of the men in Colebrook are attempting, against the odds, to sustain the masculine legacy of provision, protection, and courage that they inherited. Others seek alternative routes to masculine identity, including commitments to religion or individually focused self-improvement. Some have succumbed to white nationalism, others to the temporary escapism of opioids. In one way or another, all are trying, in Silver's words, to piece the self back together. All the lonely men. Very often, they are doing so alone. Men have fewer friends than women and are at greater risk of isolation. The gap has widened in recent years. A 2021 report from the Survey Center on American Life identified a male friendship recession, with 15% of men saying they have no close friends, up from 3% in 1990. Unsurprisingly, these are also the men who are most likely to report feeling lonely. Daniel Cox, a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute who conducted the survey, writes, "In 1990, nearly half, 45%, of young men reported that when facing a personal problem, they would reach out first to their friends. Today, only 22% of young men lean on their friends in tough times. 36% say the first call is to their parents. This may in part be because the men are more likely to be living under the same roof as mum and dad. In 2014, 1 in 3 young adult men, 35%, were living with their parents, more than were living with a wife or partner. For women, it is the other way around. I once heard a stand-up comedian in New York open his routine by describing himself as a stay-at-home son, and then riffing off that theme. Like most jokes, it was funny because it had the sharp edge of truth. Many of these men are the inhabitants of the place sociologist Michael Kimmel labels Guyland. The failure to launch is not just a trope, it's a fact. A tragicomic sketch from Saturday Night Live aired in November 2021 showing women taking their male partners to a man park in order to socialize with other men. "Which one's yours?" asks one woman of another. Why the friendship deficit among men? For one thing, men tend to invest less in their friendships than women, and they often rely on girlfriends or wives, not only to organize social lives, but as their principal confidant. When a marriage breaks up, women seem to do better in maintaining and building networks of friends. There is a reason why Ernest Hemingway and then Haruki Murakami, almost a century later, chose the title Men Without Women for their collections of short stories. Men on their own tend to be men alone. A guy needs somebody to be near him, says Crooks in John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. A guy goes nuts if he ain't got nobody. I tell you, a guy gets too lonely and he gets sick. At the extreme are the young men who'd retreat from society altogether. The trend is most pronounced in Japan, where the rising number of hikikomori, or shut-ins, has prompted widespread national concern and even some government action in the form of online support. Some hikikomori have been living in one room for years. This is not a formal medical condition, and many are not obviously mentally ill, but the term severe social withdrawal is often used. There are now more than 500,000 of these modern-day hermits, according to a survey from the Japanese Cabinet Office. Some desperate parents are paying rental sisters to write notes to and talk on the phone with their hikikomori sons in the hope that this will lead them back into mainstream society. Nor are these just young men, or at least not anymore. A third are over 40. On one level, the hikikomori are conducting a silent rebellion. Many cite the workaholic culture of the nation as one of the reasons for their withdrawal, but the dangers are obvious. The longer the hikikomori remain apart from society, the more aware they become of their social failure, says Micah Elan, who photographed many of them for a National Geographic story. They lose whatever self-esteem and confidence they had, and the prospect of leaving home becomes ever more terrifying, she writes. Locking themselves in their room makes them feel safe. The concern among some scholars is that where Japan leads, other nations may follow. An organization to work with Italian hikikomori has been established. A US researcher, Alan Teo, associate professor at Oregon Health and Science University, believes that hikikomori may be more widespread than many believe. He's worked to define and measure the syndrome with a new 25-item questionnaire, the HQ25. Even if relatively few men will totally withdraw, there are many more who are some way along the hikikomori spectrum, Teo believes. As he says, we have a large number of people in the US in their early 20s living in the basement bedroom. Oftentimes it is younger men, struggling with work, struggling with launching. There is some element of still being stuck in an earlier developmental phase. Male orchids. Is your child a dandelion or an orchid? An odd question, I know, but psychologists use these terms to distinguish between children who are pre-resilient, mostly able to cope with adversity and stress, dandelions, and those who are more sensitive to their conditions, orchids. If things are just right, orchids will really bloom. If not, they will suffer. Psychologists are still arguing over how far the orchid-dandelion dichotomy can be applied at the individual level, but in the meantime, social scientists are piling up the evidence that boys suffer worse consequences from childhood adversity. Boys raised in families in the bottom fifth of the income distribution, for example, are less likely to escape poverty as an adult than girls from similarly poor homes. If Horatio Alger was writing his rags-to-riches stories today, his principal characters would need to be girls. This is not just a US phenomenon. In Canada, for example, boys born into the poorest households are about twice as likely as girls to remain poor as adults, according to Miles Corak, an economist at the Graduate Center CUNY. Perhaps even more striking, in the US, boys raised poor are less likely than girls to be in paid work at the age of 30. As Raj Chetty and his co-authors write, gender gaps in adulthood have roots in childhood, perhaps because poverty and exposure to disadvantaged neighborhoods during childhood are particularly harmful for boys. Boys do especially badly if they are raised not only in poor families, but in poor places. There is growing evidence that neighborhoods matter for long-term outcomes, but they seem to matter more for boys than girls. Boys do badly, for example, if they're raised in neighborhoods with high levels of crime. And a large share of single-parent households seems to be particularly detrimental to boys. This is why boys seem to fare particularly poorly in certain cities, including Baltimore, as well as places like Detroit and Fresno, while outcomes for girls are less influenced by their zip code. On the plus side, black boys raised in neighborhoods with a high proportion of fathers have better prospects as adults. The bottom line, according to Chetty, is that neighborhoods matter more for boys than girls. There is a similar dandelion orchid story in education. The developmental gap between boys and girls starting kindergarten is much wider for children from homes with less educated mothers and less involved fathers. In high school, boys' academic performance is much more affected by family background, measured in terms of income, parental education, and marriage, than girls. The bigger impact of class position on boys and men is also clear in post-secondary education. Girls raised in the poorest families, i.e. the bottom fifth of the distribution, are 57% more likely to get a four-year college degree than boys from similar backgrounds, compared to a difference of just 8% among those from affluent, top fifth families. In the UK, the gender gap in college attendance is widest for those who are eligible for free school meals. Last but not least, boys suffer more from family instability, especially from the exit of biological fathers. Boys raised by single parents, especially single mothers, have worse outcomes than girls, including their own sisters, at school, and lower rates of college enrollment, in part because of bigger differences in behavioral problems in the classroom. Boys do especially poorly in broken families, write Marianne Bertrand and Jessica Pan. Boys also benefit much more than girls from successful placement into a foster family, rather than remaining in a group home, according to an analysis by Stanford's Cameron Taylor. Looked at from every angle, then, the pattern is clear. Economic and social disadvantage hurts boys more than girls. This is an extremely important fact, and one that has yet to receive nearly enough attention. The problems of men are not only fueling social and economic inequality, but also being caused by it. A vicious cycle may ensue, write David Autor and Melanie Wasserman, with the poor economic prospects of less educated males creating differentially large disadvantages for their sons, thus potentially reinforcing the development of the gender gap in the next generation. New gender economics. The dominant narrative of gender equality is framed almost exclusively in terms of the disadvantages of girls and women. But if we consider gender equality in the context of both race and class, a different picture emerges. Especially at the bottom of the economic ladder, it is boys and men who are falling behind girls and women. As Miles Corak writes, public policy needs to be informed by a new gender economics, at least when it comes to social mobility. There are important differences between the life prospects of boys and girls from less advantaged families. Any serious effort to improve rates of upward mobility or reduce economic inequality must take into account the specific challenges being faced by boys and men. Otherwise, patterns of male disadvantage will repeat across generations. That will be bad for everyone, including women and children, especially boys. This will require more than a policy tweak here or a quick initiative there. These problems run deep and require a commensurate response. The good news is that the clear connection between economic inequality and the male malaise provides the possibility of bipartisan action. Conservatives worried about boys and men need to be concerned about economic inequality. But liberals worried about inequality must pay more attention to boys and men.